Okay, so, well, apologies, because I was supposed to talk about lambda and alpha fluorescent emission, but we are relying on simulation time, and this simulation never ending. And so I had to switch to something different, but since people told me that they're very interested and they would like to hear something, I will leave 5-10 minutes at the end talking about what we are doing without showing many results, though. I mean, so the first talk is about the Allo occupation distribution of 2DF galaxies and quasars. It's basically based on two different papers. One, 2003, where we discussed the Allo occupation number of red and blue galaxies in 2DF, and one more recent, which is in press now, which discusses quasars' occupation number and some issues related to their to the quasar lifetime and similar things. So, when you try to become a young cosmology theorist, you are inspired by your local gurus, and they tell you that every galaxy forms as a concentrated luminous core embedded in an extensive dark matter halo. So, well, if you believe that, I think we all believe that at the moment, you can't go much beyond this naive understanding with present-day models, because galaxy formation is quite complicated. And on the other hand, we think that we totally solved the problem of dark matter halo formation, dark matter cluster in general. And so we think that through numerical simulation and some semiotic model calibrated onto simulations, we can reliably and readily simulate and compute the mass function and the clustering properties of dark matter halos. So a simple exercise would be to try to establish a connection between galaxies in a survey and dark matter halos, for instance, in a simulation. Well, you can't go much further with this phenological description, but anyhow, it might be useful to constrain galaxy formation model and also to build mock galaxy catalogs, which are always useful to check whether your analysis of galaxy surveys is affected by systematics or not. So what we would really like to do is, given a rather artist impression of galaxy distribution, so you have ellipticals and spirals there, you would like to say in which dark matter halo they reside. And if you have a galaxy distribution like that, you need to realize that it's pretty difficult to do it object by object, okay? So the only way you can do something like that is statistically. So, yeah, but clusters. Yeah. So this led in the last few years to developing a huge machinery that's been known as the Halo model for large clay structure. So basically, what does it mean? So this is the dark matter distribution and numerical simulation, and you basically forget about all the filaments and so on. You just concentrate on the visualized object to trace this structure, and you associate galaxies or even the mass distribution only to this object, and you compute your statistical quantities like the correlation function based on the occupation of the object you're interested in inside these halos. So this is not a new idea. Actually, in 1952, close to here, in a mysterious statistical laboratory in University of California, don't know which University of California, actually, Neyman and Scott already forwarded this idea. They say, a theory of the spatial distribution of galaxies built based on the following four main assumptions. One, galaxies occur only in clusters. Two, the number of galaxies varies from cluster to cluster, subject to a probabilistic law. Three, the distribution of galaxies within a cluster is also subject to a probabilistic law. And four, the distribution of cluster centers in space is a probabilistic law described by a quasi-uniform. Okay? Well, the revised version has been proposed in the 70s by McLellan and Silk, Peebles in the 80s. And now we go to the modern thing. So what we would like to do today is simply take your mass function of halos and your correlation function of halos different masses from a numerical simulation or from some analytic approximation to that, populate the halos with galaxies according to what is called the halo occupation distribution, which is the probability of finding n galaxies of a given type inside a halo with median mass m. So it's a full distribution. Sometimes you hear about the halo occupation number instead. The halo occupation number is the mean of that distribution. So it's the mean number of galaxies of a given type, which is inside a halo of mass m. So this distribution is much more richer because of all the higher moments inside, okay? So how can you determine that? Do you have a pointer somewhere? Well, okay, it doesn't matter really. Yeah. In principle, you can determine all the moments of this probability distribution studying clustering of galaxies at the endpoint level. But of course, this is just a principle thing, because in practice, noise in your survey will limit you to the very lowest values of n. Is this? Oh, okay. Yeah. Looks like the rector. So what we will do today is simply limit ourselves to the first two moments of the halo occupation number. Thank you for changing slides. That's fine. And so we will limit our analysis to the mean density of galaxy and the two-point correlation function. So how do this quantity depend on the moments of the halo occupation distribution? So you can write the mean density of galaxies as an integral of the halo mass of the mass function of the halos times what is called the halo occupation number, so the mean number of galaxies which is inside the halo mass m. At the same time, you can write your two-point correlation function of galaxies as the sum of two terms. One which is due to galaxies which reside in different halos, which is what is psi 2h, two halo term, and galaxies which reside inside the same halo, which is the one halo term. Of course, as you can expect, they dominate different regimes of the correlation function. If you want to be in the same halo, it's better you're close to each other, so a small separation. If you want to be in different halos, you have to be a large separation. So, well, here especially are pretty complicated. So what really matters here is that for the one halo term, what matters is the second moment of the distribution. So the dispersion around the mean, which gives you roughly the number of pairs you have in a halo. And what matters also the spatial distribution of this galaxy inside halo. Because, of course, you have more or less pairs at a given separation depending on how these galaxies are distributed inside the halo. For the two halo term, the only thing we really matter is beyond the clustering of the dark matter halos, is the mean number of galaxies that you have inside the halo, so the halo occupation number. So what we did, we took the 2DF catalog, we separated blue and red galaxies according to the principal component analysis of the spectrum. Actually, someone else did it for us. We used the result by Madwick et al. We assume a cosmology, standard cosmological model, and we apply the halo model to see whether we are able to reproduce the two-point correlation function of red and blue galaxies in the 2DF survey. So, for instance, we compute the nonlinear correlation function of dark matter using Pico-Redox algorithm. You can also use Smith et al. Nothing changes. We use the halo mass function and clustering amplitude from Schette-Thorben. We account for halo exclusion effects, the fact that two halos are specially extended so they cannot overlap. And we also try to see whether the data can constrain the spatial distribution of galaxies inside halos. So we consider both Navarro-Frankel-Wild models and some different power loss distribution for the galaxies inside halos. So the weak point of the analysis is that at a certain point you have to parameterize your unknown quantity of the halo occupation distribution. So there has been a lot of literature about that, based on both on semi-analytic modeling and hydro simulations. So what is this plot? So we are plotting here the halo mass versus the mean number of galaxies that this halo contain in some semi-analytic model and some hydro simulation. And you see that it has a characteristic shape. So basically, there is a cutoff at low masses. So if you want a galaxy with a given brightness, you can't find it in an infinitesimally small halo. You need to have a minimum mass. There is a jump, then there is a relatively flat part, and then an explosion like a power law. So now in the last year, let's say, there has been even more detailed understanding of this. Basically, the first jump and the flat part is due to the appearance of a central galaxy in the halo, and the power law part is due to the satellite galaxies around the central one. I think, but I'm not sure, is some model which is always a power law where the number scales linearly with the mass of the halo. Actually, I don't remember. It doesn't really matter. I mean, you can show that different luminosities of different colors move this curve around, but the shape is basically the same. We even try, you know, taking semi-analytic models and look what happens at high redshift, and you still find a shape like that.
Points are data.
Huh? Points are data. Well, data. Simulations, okay?
Oh, so one of the curves are
analytical. The curve analytical fits to that. Okay. And then you can see what happens to the second moment that you still need for your simulation. What is not very clear in this plot, but what you find is that whenever a halo contains more than one galaxy on average, it scatters Poissonian. And whenever a halo contains less than one galaxy on average, it scatters sub-Poissonian. And again, you can use your either hydro or semi-analytic models to calibrate the functional dependence on that, and they both agree. So we take these recipes, we use this data of the correlation function of 2DF galaxies, contains roughly 10 to the 5 galaxies, and the distinguishing passive and adaptive galaxies. Again, spectral classification using principal component analysis. You see that the power law fit to the correlation function is quite different. Early types much steeper with larger correlation length. And we apply the halo model. How do we apply it? We try to simultaneously fit the mean number of galaxies and the projected correlation function in real space, so we don't have redshift space distortions. We use a least squares fitting procedure. We use the full covariance matrix of the correlation function, so we keep into account that error bars are correlated. And we have to search for a five-dimensional parameter space. Well, these are the parameters, not really important what they are. So this is the best fit we get for what is called early type galaxy in the 2DF survey. Of course, it's not clear what luminosity corresponds. The 2DF is a flux-limited survey. So it's fitted well by a threshold, which is around 12.6 in log of solar masses. You have a sort of flattened part for a factor of 10 roughly mass, and then an explosion which is roughly linear with mass. So halo twice as massive contains twice as many galaxies, okay? The benefit is obtained assuming that the galaxy are distributed inside the halo has a Navarro-Frankel-White profile, and, well, actually you can see the plot. The chi-square per degrees of freedom is 1.3. So these are the data. This is the model. This is the two halo term. And this is one halo term. It's not clear, actually. People is discussing that, and, well, I think maybe Gus knows better, but.
Well, yes, it's been done in the big hand, but then more in Stanford, and by the big hand, the concentrations were low, it's a little three, whereas the simulation says it should be on top.
And if anything, you see that the data are much more power low than the model. So we are missing power here. But anyhow, it doesn't contribute much to chi-square because these errors are all correlated with each other. Sorry. Yeah.
So that, going back to that other plot, so I think that when it's decreasing, it goes up, it's just something that's decreasing and then coming back up.
Yeah, the model is a double power low, okay? The model is a cutoff plus two power lows. So the power lows can go anywhere.
So how hard is it to get that other power? Should I really believe it's going down?
Actually, I was going to say that in the conclusion part. There are other people who use totally different methods. For instance, conditional luminosity function, Ojumo, Van den Bosch, this kind. And they find it decreasing as well when they integrate over their conditional luminosity function. So, you know, the error bus is pretty large, so it's completely consistent with being flat instead of going down. But, you know, if anything, you find something that... So I would say that there, you cannot expect... Yeah. Well, look at that. It's minus 0.2. Yeah. Okay. It's the least determined parameter there, okay? You can do the same game. Changing the density profile. And these are different power loads for vapor profile. It's minus 2, the single thermosphere. Then you have minus 2.5, minus 3, which is the blue. And basically, you see that the only two really fit the data are either a very frankly white or a single thermosphere. This is the result for late type galaxies. And you see that the mass threshold is much lower. It's basically, this doesn't matter. It's really a single power law, which is much flatter than one. So this time, the number of galaxies increased less than the mass in the halo. The fit is much worse. And actually, the only way to fit the data is to assume that your galaxy are associated to the halo even at 2 virial radii. If you stick the galaxy inside 1 virial radius, you never fit the clustering, actually. When I came here, I was actually triggered by the talk by Anatoly Klipin, in which he was saying that for galaxy-sized halo, the definition of virial radius, according to him at least, doesn't work that well. You need to go beyond. And that actually would suggest to go in the same directions. If you want to see the data, you see that, again, the problem is here in this 2 to 5 megaparsecs scale. So change density profile. Fun enough here, the best fit to the data you have is given by the single thermosphere, but 2DF provides also a lower limit, a low separation, in which they can't really measure the correlation function because they have fiber collision problems. And that is below the lower limit. So again, the best model is again Navarro Frankel White. The single thermosphere, yeah. This is accounted, actually, in the sense they live in different halos, so they have different concentrations in the halos. So if you plot the radial distribution inside halos, it's not the same with the other ones. Yeah. Well, if you take the redshift space distortion analysis by the 2DF team and you see what kind of velocity dispersion associated with galaxies, they totally match what we find from the halo occupation number. Okay. So conclusion of the galaxy part is, well, you have a bunch of numbers there, which is, well, they are worth. But I think the important part is the last one, that after our work, other people tried this with more complicated approaches like the conditional luminosity function or from totally different samples like the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and all the results are perfectly consistent. And so this suggests that the halo model is becoming a robust statistics, even though people, I saw a paper on AstroPH recently, started using that to fit cosmological parameters, coupling it to the WMAP analysis, and that must be taken a bit, you know, with suspicion at least. Yeah.
What is the halo clustering that you use? You said that the worst part is sort of the
halo clustering. We use Shetland Tormann. You're totally right. We tried using a simulation, actually. It doesn't have that problem.
Even with simulation, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't have the problem. Simulation goes well.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. We did it afterwards, though. In the papers like that. So recently, we played the same game with 2DF quasars. So in this case, we computed ourselves the correlation function. So, for a series of reasons, we limited our analysis in this redshift range, in which completeness correction are lower. And so we consider just 14,000 quasars with this limiting magnitude. And actually, we do the analysis keeping them in a single redshift bin and splitting them in three different redshift bins. And this is the effective redshift of the samples. This is the mean density of the object. And so this is the resulting correlation function. Of course, you cannot expect from a quasar survey the same accuracy you have in a galaxy survey. So there are these, again, projected correlation function, real space. So there are no redshift distortions here. We just have 6 or 7 points in which we can measure the correlation function reliably. And these are contours for the parameters in a power law fit in the four different redshift bins. And as you can see, they are strongly correlated. So when you think about what is the correlation length, please pay attention that there is a strong degeneracy between correlation length and slope. Anyhow, the best fitting model, which is the red line, and these are the data for the whole redshift bin, is a slope of roughly 1.5 and a correlation length similar to what galaxies have today. But what came as a surprise in some sense is that people are struggling since years whether the correlation function of quasars change with redshift or not. And what we find is pretty strong signal that it does. So this red line is the same in all the plots and is the best power law fit to the whole sample. And you see that if you go in the high redshift sample, the correlation function is a log plot, is roughly a factor of two higher. So if you stick to a fit with constant gamma, you find that this is significant at the 4 sigma level. So actually you can't say that the correlation function is really evolving, because these are flux-limited surveys, so you're seeing by things a high redshift. So could be either evolution or simply the fact that you are seeing brighter things. Okay, we are actually investigating now whether we can distinguish between the two. Sorry? Yeah, fine, but you know, you see a very tiny window in the luminosity function in the 2QZ survey. So.
Oh, okay, so
yeah, you know. So, what is the plot here? Sorry, there was supposed to be a plot there of the bias, but it's not there. anyhow, what was in the famous plot was that the bias of this object increases rapidly with redshift. So it goes from something like 1.6 at redshift 1 to something which is close to 4 at redshift 2. And so you can play again the allo question number. For these objects, the only difference is that you don't have any constraint for the small separation clustering, because there are very few quasar pairs. And so your models are degenerate, and you have to invent a way to break your degeneracy. So what we did, we used two different approaches. One is based on the quasar lifetime must be larger than was suggested by the proximity effect. And the other approach is that we assumed that the correlation between the circular velocity of the host galaxy and the mass of the black hole that is seen at low redshift is still valid at high redshift. And these are A and B practically, and but you see that they give you exactly the same answer. Okay? So this is, again, mass of the host halo, number of quasars inside, different redshifts, this is the whole redshift bin. Okay? So what is the conclusion here? Basically that in order to have a quasar, a 2QZ quasar, so an optically bright quasar, you need to be in a halo which is larger than 10 to the 12 solar masses, and typically is 10 to the 13 solar masses. Okay, this is the summary. So what can you infer from that? Actually, you can compute, you know that these are in halos of roughly 10 to the 13 solar masses. So you know how many there should be, if you know the cosmology. You know how many quasars you have. So you can see what is the fraction of active quasars inside. And from that, you can infer with some assumption the duty cycle and then the quasar lifetime. So what we find that a redshift of 1, less than 1% of the available host half a quasar inside, while a redshift 2 is roughly 5 to 10%. And if you convert this into a quasar lifetime, you find that your quasar lifetime ranges from a few 10 to the 7 years to 10 to the 8 years. So what you have to assume in order to convert this into this is that basically you have just one galaxy per halo. So in some sense it's degenerate with the number of black holes that you could have which are not bright in the halo, okay? But actually in the paper we have a long discussion about that. And we think that at least for these redshifts is a perfectly plausible assumption. So in principle, yes, is the answer. Yeah, so if you have many bursts, it would be exactly the same number.
If there are many bursts, there would be shorter than that, but that would be the total.
Yeah, yeah, this is the integrator. So it's the, basically the unit cycle, okay?
For the more massive ones, if you go beyond tens of certain solar masses, I think you couldn't tell the difference if you just give it up.
Well, this is done at 10 to 15 solar masses. So we just use halos at 10 to the 13 solar masses to infect those numbers. We don't go beyond, because beyond it's, you know, it's a mess.
Sorry, yeah, just coming back to my question.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I understood your answer. Mm-hmm. So is it you're saying that you can put a strong lower limit to the quasar lifetime, provided that...
You say lower, sorry.
Lower.
Lower limit. No, it's basically put by hand by our prior. Yeah.
So there's no
lower limit. No, because if you want to fit the clustering, you can do it putting the quasars in very low mass halos, but with a very, 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 very low occupation number, okay?
Yes.
Which is insane in some sense, because at a certain point your halos become less massive than the black hole which powers the quasars, okay? But in principle, you can exactly play the same game and fit everything. And in that case, the quasar lifetime would be
so
1 year. You know.
Basically.
Well, the constraint comes when beyond the clustering and the abundance, you introduce another observable, which in the galaxy case is the small-scale clustering. In this case, we don't have it. So we use either the lower limit introduced by the proximity effect, which basically says nothing can be beyond 10 to the 6 years, something like that, below, yeah. And so this automatically breaks the degeneracy, gives you a unique answer. Or you stick to the other case in which you say, I know what is the mass of the black hole, more or less, and for the mass of the black hole, I have basically a limit of the mass of the halo that can host it. And they give exactly the same answer as the plot I showed you before. But again, the lower limit, you should put it in with the extra information. So.
You also explained this by saying that you have the same lifetime, except that the number of important quasars changes the pressure.
I'm not sure I got the question right.
So you say that if you compare the number of quasars and the number of halos,
yeah,
in different redshifts,
yeah,
you find that redshift 2, you have 1%, redshift lower, then you have 5%.
Yeah, at a given mass.
Right. So, but that, and then you convert at lifetime. So you could also say that the formation of quasars changes with redshift, and they all have the same lifetime.
No, but it's inside already there, you know?
The same argument here.
Yeah.
It's just the integrated lifetime. So,
No, you can't say that it comes automatically from the model. Once, the game you are playing, you know the clustering, okay?
Yeah.
You want to reproduce the clustering. So you say in which halos they need to reside, okay? At that point, when you know in which halo, suppose that there's just one mass, okay? You know the halo, so you know the abundance of that halos, but you know how many quasars you have.
Yeah.
So the ratio automatically gives you a lifetime.
For some reason, 10% of those halos, those
quasars,
and the other 90 don't.
Never.
They never did, and then the lifetime's the same, so then the numbers come out.
What do you mean? So the assumption is that all the halos are the same, okay? They look alike.
Okay. But that's
assumption.
Yeah. Well, that's so if you produce a halo, we never saw a black hole, so it must be black hole inside. Okay.
It's much better to understand this statement in the context of the duty cycle.
Yeah.
Actually, last time it was a bit confusing.
Yeah, okay. So if you want the like duty cycle, it's this number.
Not either, but
yeah. Okay, well, what else? Basically, the fact that both priors agree shows you that there is also a paper by Loeb about that, that the locally observed correlation it's consistent with being still valid or greater than one. And, well, systematic searches for close quasar pairs are needed because there aren't such an object. So this is actually last point before switching to 11 alpha, okay. So these data come from Shaoui, and and is simply the mean density of quasars brighter than this as a function of redshift in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, I think. And now all these confusing, but what they want to show is that the halo cover cannot be constant with time. Because, so these lines are lines in which you keep your halo cover number constant. And, well, this is, let's go for the low redshift part, okay? They evolve like that. These blue lines are what is observed in the 2DF for the mean density of quasars. So basically, the interpretation could be that since you have galaxy formation using up the gas, and this gas is not available anymore for accretion of the quasars, and so what you see at low redshift is that the density goes down, and so at least your normalization of the allocation number must change. But at high redshift, this is just tentative interpretation, at least these 4 points are consistent with a constant allocation number, okay? Which again is something between 10 to the 12 and 10 to the 13th solar masses as a threshold. So, this is ever some advertisement, just to break. Right, we were driving on Sunday and we saw this, we couldn't resist, okay? And so now, last, how many minutes? I have no idea.
7 minutes.
The other talk? That has been the reason for which I slept very little tonight. So, what is this? It's not a flag, okay? So this is a medium. Actually, it's a hydrogen distribution, suppose homogeneous, and this is empty space, okay? So at a certain point, you shine this slab of hydrogen with the UV background. What happens? Well, you start ionizing the medium, they ionized here, less here, less here, certain point becomes shielded. Okay? Well, what happens in these regions? That since this is continuously ionized by the background, you have recombinations going on, and recombination produces radiation. Okay? Radiation that is roughly isotropically emitted, and could be possible that some of this radiation comes out, and you can see this slab just because it's emitting recombination radiation. So why, in the title, there is this confusing word fluorescent that a lot of people don't like. The reason for which it's called fluorescence is that if, for instance, you switch off your background, you will just have a little burst of this recombination radiation, but after it has recombined, everything comes back to this. So it's fluorescent just because you need to illuminate it to have something back, okay? So there are two seminal papers about this, one by Hogan and Weimann and by Gould and Weinberg. And so what are the theoretical predictions? Well, we know from atomic physics that 36% of hydrogen recombination, this is assuming 20,000 degrees of temperature, but depends very little on the temperature, lead to lemma alpha emission. But if the medium is optically thick to continuum photons, every time you recombine, the photons can be absorbed close by, and so you increase this probability that can reach 65% if the medium is really thick and no continuum photon leaks out, okay? Once you produce this line alpha photon, what they do? They execute random walk because they are continuously absorbed and re-emitted by neutral atoms. And since each atom has a motion, they take a Doppler shift, and so the random walk is both in space and frequency, and this keeps going on until they scatter with a with an atom which lies in the wing of the Boltzmann distribution, and they simply jump out because they're out of the line, okay? So if you sum up these things together, what you find is an optically thick cloud should act as a fluorescent mirror, which converts two-thirds of the photons in the UV background into laminar alpha radiation. And another ingredient is that if you believe that this plane parallel approximation, in which the density distribution is homogeneous, the surface brightness of the object should be totally uniform when you shine with a uniform background. So, this. Well, we were assuming an infinite slab. We think that objects in the sky, something like laminar system, should be something like a sphere. So they have meatball topology. So the same applies, the same argument applies rigorously if the shielding layer of this object is small with respect to radius of curvature of the object, okay? So what about observations? Well, it's damn hard to detect this radiation, okay? Because if you believe Piero and Francesco background predictions, that corresponds to a surface brightness in laminar alpha, which is something like 10 to the minus 20 erg per centimeter squared per second per erg second squared. So there has been a few blind searches, which, well, to my knowledge, have only produced null results, going from Lowenthal, Martinez-Gonzalez, Bunker et al. Now, I learned yesterday from Martin that there is an ongoing program to detect that at redshift around 3. And it has been also realized that if instead of using the UV background, you use some positive fluctuations in the background, you should increase your signal. And so people thought about using a quasar, so I just image a region close to a quasar, I should see something higher than that. And it has been done very recently by Francis and Blandothorn. So based on the Gulden-Weinberg model and, the quasar model they have, they were, and the number of laminar limited system observed on average, they were expecting to detect 6 clouds above their detection limit, but they didn't see any. So there is a long discussion in the paper, and what they conclude is probably because they quasi-ionized everything. Okay. That is not the only argument they propose. There are many more. Okay. Just a note. We have recently proposed a proposal based on our theoretical work to work in this regime with a quasar, actually. So why is it interesting at all to look at that? Well, first of all, and I think is the main motivation, for instance, of Martin, is that if you measure the brightness of this, you can measure the ionizing background. Redshift 3. Well, what else? If you image these objects and you measure their size distribution, you can learn something about what Lyman limit systems are. They should be basically Lyman limit systems, because the condenser is 10 to the 18 is the one that makes them thick. So. And then, a bit more shaky, but in the vicinity of a quasar, you can think about measuring the opening angle, the beaming of the UV emission, if you see differences in the brightness in one direction, it's better than another, okay? So what I'm doing, and basically this is the work of a graduate student in Zurich, is can be summarized this way. So we have a hydro simulation of structure formation, and which uses a Eulerian code, 10 megaparsec, redshift 3, 512 cubic zones. We propagate a UV background through that, and what we do, well, I won't go in details. We propagate UV background to that in a, I think, clever way. this is done doing ray tracing and solve the ionization equilibrium in each cell, and we do two cases. In one, we inject Hermadal background from the region of mean density, and the other, we add a quasar emission that comes from one side of the box, okay? So in that In this case, we can know what is the recombination rate in each point in the box. At that point, we can do line transfer, doing a full Monte Carlo simulation of the scattering, and this produces images of the Lamma alpha emission. So this would be the whole box. This is just column density, though. And, well, these red things are the optically thick objects. And unfortunately, it's basically impossible to do the Raman alpha scattering in the whole box, so we have to concentrate this on small sub-boxes. And I think the next one is something close to here. So this is, again, the column density distribution. This is without the quasar, so just Hermodau, and this with the quasar. Of course, you see that the things are smaller because they see a higher ionizing flux. And this is broadband image of Lamma alpha emission. And there is a surprising thing that, so based on Gutenberg, you would expect to have back 2/3 of what you inject with the background. And actually, the maximum in our box is around half of that. And so we could identify a couple of reasons for this. And one is that the things are not slabs, and the density distribution in an object is continuous, and so you have a transition from something which is thick, something which is thin continuously, and this increases the probability of scattering in other directions. And the other is affects something like the forest, the fact that things are in the foreground can still scatter your photon out of the lens sight. And so for this reason, they are not uniform. And so this is, again, is without the quasar. This is with the quasar. Actually, look, the scales are different because if you use the same scale, this would look like that. And so this is the reason we believe that, well, would be easier to detect this object if you had the quasar, okay? The quasar is in front. So these are in the background of the quasar. And this is the reason for which we submitted the proposal. Someone is in the ESO panel here, please consider that. And so what's the status now? That before I, you know, being fully quantitative, we want to study resolution effects clearly. And so I'll stop here.
I just wanted to